absolutely agree with all of that, Paul, particularly the part about it being a wonderful role to get to dig into. Obviously, since Clive exists in the public mind as he's connected to the Branch Davidians, you have a decision to make right at the beginning of your preparation, which is, do I look more closely at how this person portrays themselves, or do I pay more attention to what other people say about this person? And I tend to think it's more interesting to go into this person's own views of themselves.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guests this week, my tour is happening. I'm doing stand-up in Omaha at the Omaha Funny Bone, May 5th and 6th, Friday and Saturday. If you're in the area, come on out. It's been a few years since I've been there because of COVID, so I'm the guy that shut Omaha down. So I got that going for me. So come on out. It's been a while. Got a lot of fun new stuff. Play around with the crowd. As you know, I like to do that, and hope you guys can make it. Go to omahafunnybone.com for tickets, or my website, paulmercurio.com. That voice you heard is a terrific actor in drama and comedy, John Hogenacker, and he's a really, really terrific actor. You know him as a Bud Light King, but also from Dope Sick and Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan. He plays Matisse on Amazon, and he's in a new Showtime limited series, Waco, The Aftermath. And that's him talking about sort of how he prepped for this role, and because he did a lot of research on the character he played, which was one of the Branch Davidians. So it was a really cool conversation with him, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. Before we get to the full interview, I stay in hotels a lot. I don't get the daily housekeeping thing, but I don't do that at home. Then again, I don't put a do not disturb sign on my bedroom door, and maybe I should at home, but what are we doing in hotel rooms? Are we really soiling the sheets on a daily basis that we have to change them? How much stuff are you throwing out that you got to empty the garbage every day? Can we just relax, give these maids a break? You know, if you want to service the room, I got other things that, you know, maybe you could call a special service, if you know what I mean, for that kind of service. Don't tell my wife. I don't need people in and out all day cleaning things, moving stuff around. Who knows? You know, sniffing my socks. Okay, maybe that's just a fantasy I have. So enough with the housekeeping every day. Give the guys a break. Give the women, the men, let them rest. All right. Enjoy, John. It's a terrific conversation with him. And May 5th and 6th, Omaha Funny One. Hope to see you there. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week, a very accomplished, terrific actor, stage and screen. He's one of the stars of the Showtime limited series, Waco, The Aftermath. You know him from Dope Sick as Black Ops operative Matisse and Amazon's Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan. He's the Bud Light King in the Bud Light commercials. Also a terrific turn in The Iceman Cometh on stage. John Hogenacker, it's great to have you on the show.
Great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've really been a fan of your work, and you're playing the role of Clive Doyle in this Waco Aftermath series, David Koresh's first follower in the Branch Davidians, who really always shocked me that, you know, he continued to have faith in even after the Mount Carmel fire, where he lost a daughter. And I was fascinated by, as an actor, how this must be a great role to play, because it seems to me characters like this or people like this are pretty complex. And so that has to be a real nice hunk of meat to sink your teeth into as an actor. What was that like for you to play this? What was your research like? What did you learn about these kinds of people in sort of preparing for the role?
Absolutely agree with all of that, Paul, particularly the part about it being a wonderful role to get to dig into. Obviously, since Clive exists in the public mind, as he's connected to the Branch Davidians, you have a decision to make right at the beginning of your preparation, which is, do I look more closely at how this person portrays themselves, or do I pay more attention to what other people say about this person? And I tend to think it's more interesting to go into this person's own views of themselves. And one of the things that I think the show gets right is that it doesn't It doesn't seek to excuse the Branch Davidians or portray them as being faultless or guiltless in everything that went down, nor does it seek to exonerate the federal government for the mistakes that it made at the siege. Clive had a fascinating life. I'm interested in how a person's choices in life and how their path leads them to seminal events in their lives. And Clive begins his life in Australia as a Seventh-day Adventist and attends a church service or a church gathering of a sort of an offshoot group. And these people were Davidians, not Branch Davidians, but Davidians. And when word got back to his regular congregation that he and his mother had attended this meeting, they were excommunicated. So they attended more meetings with this group and more meetings. And then as a young man, he and his mother immigrate to Texas from Australia to join the community at Mount Carmel outside of Waco. So Clive had been a Branch Davidian for 30 years when the standoff occurred. He had two daughters, and one of whom died in the fire. And he had been throughout his life, kind of perhaps because he was always sort of trying to proselytize people, the subject of a great amount of bullying. And so he was viewing the world through that lens. And when he meets Vernon Howell, who would later become David Koresh, he's immediately drawn to his charisma and his perception of Howell's strength. And certainly Howell was apparently able to quote large swaths of the Bible from memory, which just sort of blew everyone away. And after a few years, there's a schism in the Branch Davidians, and a bunch of people leave and go with Vernon Howell, who by this point is becoming David Koresh, and some people stay behind with Lois Roden. So it is kind of a twisting, turning story that gets them all back together, all back at Mount Carmel when the standoff happens. The show looks at how Vernon Howell becomes David Koresh. It also looks at the trials that follow the siege. When the surviving members of the Branch Davidians are put on the stand and tried in the murders of four federal agents. And it also looks at the concurrent rise of the white nationalists and separatist movements who are using the events at Waco to sort of recruit followers and using it as a reason for, from their perspective, striking back at the government in 1995, on the two-year anniversary of the burning of Waco when they bombed the Murrah building in Oklahoma City, a connection which I had never made.
Yeah, I didn't either. And also the cool thing about the series is sort of there's also a line to January 6th in a way, and it all makes sense when you kind of take a 30,000-foot view of it. I'm glad you brought up sort of Clive's, you know, the deep background on him, because it seems, you know, he didn't have a father figure, and I almost felt like his proselytizing was a way to have a family that he didn't have. And I don't know if you found that in thinking about it or researching it, the character, and also that Koresh maybe is the father figure that he didn't have. I don't know if that's overly simplistic psychobabble, but it's sort of like, it just seems to me that folks in this situation, you tend to look into their backgrounds, and these sort of larger than life cult-like figures are fulfilling a role that's lacking them in their own life. And I don't know if you found that, or if that helped you in playing the character at all.
I could definitely see a case for that. I think, you know, for a lot of people that end up in groups like this, it's just the attractiveness of feeling like you belong.
Yeah.
Like you fall into a group, and then that group is holding you super, super tight. And you add into that, their theology is that they've got it figured out and the rest of the world does not have it figured out, which I think is alluring too to someone who, like Clive, has kind of been a bit of an outcast for perhaps numerous reasons in his young adulthood and childhood. And then, you know, you meet a person like Koresh, and they're just so charismatic, and he kind of feels like Koresh has it all figured out. And so he follows Koresh around. There's a lot in Clive's backstory over the 13 years between when Vernon Howell arrives and when the standoff happens with the federal government, where Koresh plays a huge role in Clive's personal life that just kind of draws him closer and closer to him.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, when you found it, you found that void that can be filled, I know maybe you've done this, you're watching the news and you're like, well, how are you screaming at the TV? How could you not see that this guy's clearly a cult leader and blah, blah, blah? You become entrenched in defending the one family that you finally have, right? The one group that's finally accepted you. So, and I remember, you know, sort of seeing this in other similar characters, sort of like, you can't see the forest through the trees because you're so locked into finally being part of a group that's accepted you that you can't see the faults in that group or in that leader. Right. And I would imagine there's that. I mean, he was at one point actually negotiating, I think, with the FBI during the siege a little bit, Clive, wasn't he? And sort of playing a go-between a little bit.
Most of that fell to Koresh. Clive was for the defense. He was a real kind of a star witness because he was so mild mannered and came off as such a pacifist, kind of had lived the life of a monk essentially in this group and wanted to be super devout and to this ultra orthodox extremist theology. So Clive was the only one who did not serve the time as a result of the events at Waco. It is a fascinating thing to try and wrap your head around. And I think, you know, you talk about how people can fall into this mindset and how it's so hard to watch it from the outside and think, can't you see that this thing is corrupt in this way?
Right.
We are so in our society right now, we're so tribalized, and our views of what we perceive to be those on the other side are so calcified that I think a TV show like this could serve to soften that conversation by virtue of the fact that it sits you down at the table with two sides of a very divisive event and urges you to kind of see the humanity of the individuals involved here.
Yeah, absolutely. We're in our silos. And, you know, I completely forgot, like, Timothy McVeigh's actions in Oklahoma City were directly driven by that the injustice, and what he saw as the injustice and what happened at Waco and a pushback on that. And, you know, that, and I'm not saying, you know, and then you can take that line to January 6th, right? And it's like, it's not like January 6th happened in a vacuum. It's like, we're going back to 95 now, right? And it's the same kind of thing. It's a group of people that feels that a sister group of people have been wrong, and they're going to sort of make a right, do something to make this wrong go away. And I had completely forgotten about the connection between Waco and McVeigh, and that's still there today, you know, like, and you're right. I think this is a really good series for that it kind of dusts off some of those memories and sort of, and educates people who weren't even alive back then. Like, look at how this kind of thing is still around today. This sort of divisiveness, this kind of living in our silos, this kinds of, you know, aggressive,
these stories,
you know, violent
that
outreach.
We feed ourselves. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. I just think it's really interesting that it's a really clever series in that way, because it looks like it's been a long time ago that this all happened, but it feels like it just happened yesterday, you know?
Yeah, I absolutely. And I feel like it's, you know, these stories that, that we tell ourselves and that the tribes that we find ourselves being a member of tell us about everybody else. those stories push us further and further apart from having individual encounters with people and maybe softening the tenor of the conversation. I think it's also important to note with regards to the Branch Davidians, while their theology made them separatists by definition, they were a people apart. They were not allied with white supremacy movements or separatist movements as we know them today. The Branch Davidians were a very kind of, at least racially, very diverse group of people. And to them, they were living what they thought was a utopia. And when the thing all came down, when it all ended tragically, other groups of people who were separatists sort of used the event to draw attention right. to what they saw as their plight. I mention that because I think it's possible right now for Branch Davidians to be conflated with white nationalists. And for the sake of specificity and for history, it's important that we know that they were not actually allied. In that way, anyway.
No, I'm glad you brought that up because groups do that a lot. They'll co-opt certain aspects of another situation for their own convenience,
sure.
and in the process, sort of cast a bad light on that other group when it's unfair. And that's a really good point. So you did something. I know you went to DePaul for theater, and you're a 2-time state and district high school debate champion. In humorous interpretation. Now, I debated in school, but I didn't do humorous interpretation. And I think, by the way, I think you have a great career because you're such a great dramatic actor and you're such a good comedic actor. And I'm a comedian myself and act, but I just really think you're terrific at it. What is debating in humorous interpretation? Tell me what that, so how would that work? Because I did straight up pretty much extemporaneous debating. But not humorous interpretation. Sure. It sounds really fun.
Well, we in the National Forensics League, which is that's kind of the governing body of all these different events that happen within forensics in high school and at the college level, you have individual events as well. So I started by doing Congress, which is like essentially mock Congress. So somebody brings a bill, you debate it, you go back and forth, you learn sort of parliamentary procedure. Then you had Lincoln Douglas debate, which was one-on-one sort of moral debate. And it was extemporaneous too, in the sense that right before you go in, they tell you what you're going to be debating. And then you essentially draw for which side you're going to be arguing. And then there was policy debate, which was 2-on-2. What humorous interpretation, dramatic interpretation was, I came to that kind of in my sophomore year of high school. That was basically you choose a play or a TV show or a movie, some kind of source material, and you do a cutting. It could be a variety of scenes or it can be one big long scene. And your time limit is 10 minutes. And at some point, you have to do an introduction and you have to stay with your feet basically planted, but the upper half of your body. You take on, you portray all these different characters. So it was a great opportunity to, kind of go in and work to a dead crowd of like, 6 other teenagers giving you the stink eye because you're all competing, plus a judge at the back of the room.
Right.
And then if you make it into quarterfinals, you make it into semis, or you make it into finals. And by that point in the weekend, because all these debate meets happen on weekends, people are getting, they're dropping out of their events or they're, they haven't made it to the finals or whatever. So everybody would come to the HI event. So you'd have a huge room full of people to play to. So it was, in a way, it was kind of like stand up because you had to learn how to work a crowd.
Did you find yourself like vibing off the crowd and like in the moment, sort of making changes and adjustments to what you were doing because you could tell the crowd was going for it or not going for it and stuff like that?
Certainly in terms of like timing, and nuance of delivery, but it was so like tight to script that it wasn't like there was a ton of room in that format for improv. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. I did here in North Carolina, I was a state champion twice and was a district champion twice. And when you win the district championship, then you get to go and compete at nationals. So I got to do that a couple years. And I think as an actor, just the practice of getting up in front of people and kind of, taking that position of power in the room, casting a spell over a group of people all alive and sharing the same place, really helped me in my stage work. It helped me, you know, auditioning, all that kind of stuff. It was a huge, huge experience for me. And that debate, Beth Miller, to this day, she's like the most profound teacher I had. That she was just the best.
Yeah. What was her name again?
Barbara Miller.
Yeah. Listen, I was actually thinking about doing a mock debate with you on this, but I decided, you know, you're a champion, you'd kick my ass. So I decided to back off with that. Yeah. I don't want to mess around with the Bud Light King, but we got to wrap. But oh, by the way, the cat, the commercials with the cat. Oh my God. My wife, she's a big cat lover. Just absolutely hilarious. You're so good at the comedy because you don't overplay it. There's so much more I'd love to talk to you about. We'll have to have you back on again, man. It's a really great.
That sounds great. I look forward to it.
Career that you have. But right now, everybody should check out this really great limited series on Showtime, Waco, The Aftermath, John Hoganacker. It's really great to have you on, man. And we'll have you back on and we'll talk some more. Good luck with everything.
It's great to be on. Thanks a lot, Paul. Take care.
All right. Really enjoyed that conversation. Hope you did too. May 5th and 6th, Omaha Funny Bone. Hope you guys can make it out there. And as I always say, if you don't live near there, fly out. Come on. I'm worth it. All right. See you guys next week.